is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. Jurors in the federal gun charges trial of President Biden's son have heard testimony about Hunter Biden's drug addiction from his ex-wife and former girlfriend. Possible terrorist plot foiled, say French officials. ABC's Brian Clark.
It was Monday night at a hotel near Charles de Gaulle Airport when firefighters responded to a man with burns. That led to a search and the discovery of products used to make explosive devices. The man, now in custody, is a Russian-Ukrainian national, according to French anti-terror authorities. U.S. officials briefed say the man's currently suspected of participating in a terrorist conspiracy and bomb plot.
Six people, including a wounded alleged gunman, arrested after today's shooting near the entrance to the U.S. Embassy in Beirut. A Lebanese guard was injured, say local officials. A tornado killed a two-year-old boy and injured his mother today when a tree fell on their house in suburban Detroit in Livonia, say local officials. This is ABC News.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
Civic Media News. I'm Ella Saff. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. The warden at the maximum security state prison in Waupun is facing up to 3.5 years in prison. Randall Happ is charged with felony misconduct after an investigation into four inmate deaths. Eight other people have been charged as well. Dodge County Sheriff Dale Schmidt spoke in a press conference Wednesday about making changes to Wisconsin's prison system.
I would ask why not? One new prison could replace two prisons, or two renovated prisons would be much better than what we have now.
An internal Department of Corrections investigation is ongoing. Parents and teachers of Southside Elementary School in Madison are calling for the removal of their principal and assistant principal. An 18-page letter of complaint was sent to the Madison School District on Tuesday. Parents assert that school administrators don't listen to them. They also claim school leaders ignore bullying and punish black and brown students disproportionately. And that's what you need to know. I'm Ella Saff, and this is Civic Media News.
It's time for Civic Media's Scotty Summer Text to Win contest right here on this local Civic Media radio station. We're hooking you up with Wisconsin Dells prize packs, Milwaukee Brewers club level tickets, plus the chance to win a summer getaway to Door County, Lake Geneva, or a lake house vacation. Download the Civic Media app in the Apple or Google stores, find your station, and get set to text for your chance to win in this statewide contest. It's your shot to win with Scotty Summer on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for the Todd Allball Show.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is The Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Came across a guy named Anthony Sabatini. He's running for Congress, well, running against a Republican incumbent for Florida's 11th congressional district, who, the incumbent, far right incumbent, off the rails kind of incumbent. And I get that Anthony Sabatini needs to go even further off the rails to get some attention, and attention he got when he tweeted out the reason he's running for Congress. And why is Anthony Sabatini running for Congress? Well, his tweet says, "I'm running for Congress to imprison as many Democrats as possible." He says, "Vote for me if you believe Democrats are the enemy and must be jailed and removed from public life." Those are his words. And I don't doubt him one bit for his words, because this is what the current Republican Party. This is what the hard line is. Even though Donald Trump, who ran on lock her up, now says he didn't say lock her up again. But I got an email that made me think about this. Steve sent me an email and asked me, when I asked Bob Ney about, why would the Republicans try to destroy the judicial system? Steve wrote, they're not Republicans, they're fascists. Fascists try to delegitimize all existing institutions in the old regime. And Steve is right. He went on to say that they want to burn the old system to the ground. They try to portray all aspects of the previous system as corrupt and evil. They try to legitimize insanity. And he's spot on accurate. And, you know, this for me goes back to Newt Gingrich and, you know, getting all of the Republicans to call the Democratic Party the Democrat Party, which at the time seemed really childish, but look what it's morphed into. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to normalize what is not normal. In the age of Trump, nothing sacred. No institution is safe from scorn. No legal precedent is safe from being discarded. We're in a moment of extremism run amok. And look, the weird thing is the right will agree. You're right, Rick. They're trying to normalize what's not normal. The transgender thing. And I disagree. For them, it may not be normal. But for a country that believes in personal liberty, in a country that believes in individual rights, this isn't a deviation from Thomas Jefferson's well-known line from the Declaration of Independence, that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the fundamental bedrock of what is America. The idea of government of the people, by the people, and for the people. The idea that the ballot box, there's sanctity in that ballot box. That we're all part of this wonderful experiment of self-governance. But oh no, not for some. And I look at Kansas, and I know Thomas Frank wrote the book, What's the Matter with Kansas? Still trying to figure that out. But their Supreme Court recently came up with a split ruling that evidently says voting is not a fundamental right in their state's Constitution's Bill of Rights, that it's not a right. And it's interesting that some of the people who dissented, you know, said this is, you know, this is crazy. This is a deviation from years of precedent, all of that. And understand what they're trying to do is they're trying to normalize the idea of taking people's voting rights away, of silencing citizens' ability to participate in self-governance. You know, the idea that we're now saying, you know what, voting's not really a right, is kind of, I think one justice said it best. And it's one of those things where you go, yeah, I agree. Justice Eric Rosen said, it staggers my imagination to conclude that the citizens have no fundamental right to vote. Call the majority opinion a betrayal of our constitutional duty to safeguard the foundational rights of Kansans. And you go, yeah. And Justice Melissa Taylor Standridge said that the decision was troubling, but defies history, law, and logic. And is just plain wrong. And understand, they don't care. These extremists don't care about precedent. They don't care about decided law. You know, John Roberts, remember when John Roberts seemed to be extreme? And now we're looking to him to, be the moderation of the extreme? Remember when he said that he's going to call balls and strikes? He believes in stare decisis, decided law. And we're flipping laws over all the time. Because of their ideology, their extremist ideology, and, you know, to take a word from Steve, their fascistic ideology. So for me, we're in dangerous waters. And a big part of this for me comes back down to we need an active, engaged, educated populace, one that understands that we've seen this movie before, and it didn't end well for working people, and that maybe this election's going to matter. So again, I can't figure out what's going on in Kansas, but here you are. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Do you think running on the platform, we're going to lock up the enemy, the opponent? Do you think that's going to fly in Florida's 11th congressional district? Oddly enough, I think it will. That's how screwed up I think we are. Right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, as you know, we've been talking about vouchers the last couple of days and really windfall for the very wealthy, a way to fill the coffers of the well-to-do, the people who are already sending their kids to private schools, and of course, the religious schools. Oh, are they thrilled? Because their enrollment has gone up and their tuition, oddly enough, has gone up as well, which means at least two groups are cashing in. I would argue not the group that we were sold it was going to help, and that's poor working class kids. For them, we're going to give them underfunded public schools and then blame them when they're not getting ahead. But, you know, here we are in the 70th year since Brown versus Board of Education, and we're seeing a lot of, especially on the policy front, the difference between groups. The wealthy groups are getting those vouchers, those golden tickets that come with a windfall full of cash. And, well, the poorer students, we're going to give them cyber charters and well, other gimmicks. And here to share some thoughts on maybe how we fulfill the promise of Brown versus Board of Education, I've asked Weah Day James to come talk with us. She's a senior director of K through 12 education policy there at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org. Their website, they've got a piece out on this very topic. Weah Day, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for having me, Rick. It's a pleasure to be here.
So if I frame this right, because I see this very clearly. On the policy front, we see wealthier people, whiter people getting these golden tickets, these vouchers. And I know it's not how it's framed, but in reality, this is what's going on. Getting these vouchers and people in poverty-ridden areas, we're getting cyber charters and charter schools and all of these other gimmicks, and we're destroying the public school that was supposed to be there to give everybody a chance. That's what I see. Am I framing that right?
Rick, I think you're definitely laying out the complexities of the choice movement, right? The reality is that parents have choice, and that's a good thing, right? Parents should have the right to choose where they send their children to school, but it is very complex. As you pointed out, the voucher program is just one type of choice, and that is really defined by different states. So some states have voucher programs, and the programs look very differently. But it does create inequities in that the voucher programs allows parents to send their children to a private school, but oftentimes those vouchers don't pay the full tuition of that private school. It might cover partial tuition. So now you run into a situation where a low-income family who wants to utilize a voucher cannot afford the full tuition. Let's say the tuition is, $35,000. For that child, and the voucher program only covers half of that. That voucher only covers half the tuition. Now that family who does not have the financial means is unable to utilize the voucher. So therefore we're seeing more well-resourced, affluent families being able to put to use vouchers, and families who do not have the resources, low-income families in particular, are often left with charter schools as their only choice, right? If they want to exercise choice in terms of not sending their children to the traditional public school system. Right. But I think, with all of this discussion about charters, magnets, private schools via vouchers, I think what it really comes down to is we are taking money out of traditional public schools, right? It's disinvesting in the public school system and putting those resources into other models of schooling. When the public schools were really intended and is designed to serve all children. So how do we make sure that we're investing in our public schools, because they're the bedrock to our democracy?
Yeah, see, I see the voucher movement and the choice argument as a way to destroy public education so that we do resegregate our schools and by choice. Because, hey, you poor people, you have the choice to go to this somewhat funded charter school. And you, more affluent people, you have the choice to get away from those people. So we're giving people the choice. I'm not a big choice fan. I got to tell you, Weaday, my thought is, how about we fund one really great option and we ensure that everything a kid from top to bottom needs is in that option, that we give them all a shot to do well instead of what I grew up around. Look, I grew up in the 70s in Cleveland, and we had to live through that busing nonsense that they did. Which, in you look back on it, it didn't make people's lives better. And the kids that I grew up with, it made their lives miserable. And they didn't do, I think studies have shown this, they didn't do any better or worse than they would have done otherwise.
Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And I think you mentioned about the resource piece. Looking at how we're funding our schools, I think needs to be a discussion that we're having, not a discussion about creating more schools, right? Because public schools are so-called underperforming or whatever the case may be. We need to think about how are we currently funding those public schools that do exist. If they're underperforming, what do we need to do to get them to the level of raising test scores or increasing school climate, whatever it is that we envision for what a quality school needs to look like? What are the resources that we need to pour into those schools to make them that model of excellence? So I think that's the conversation we need to be having. Citizens and constituents should be having that with their lawmakers at the local level to think about how do we ensure that we're improving the quality of traditional public schools that are designed to serve all children. Right. And you mentioned the segregation piece. That is a big deal when we think about the rise in the charter sector. There's been a lot of research on this. The UCLA Civil Rights Project has published about this extensively, about the hyper-segregation in charter schools. Currently, about 59% of charter schools across the country are considered highly segregated. Highly segregated meaning they have 90% or more of Black or Latinx students in those schools, 60% of charter schools. So I think we need to think about, you know, the balanced model when we're authorizing charters, because where charters typically going to open up, they're not going to the suburbs, they go into urban, oftentimes low income or, you know, not racially, ethnically diverse. They go into those neighborhoods that are already segregated. And opening up schools in those areas, right? So again, creating this culture of separating and maintaining that status quo. But again, the issue is not with having choice, it's about having a quality choice. Because a charter school does not mean that it's a better choice than a traditional public school. So I think the responsibility should really be also on charter school authorizers in states, like state education agencies and charter school boards, how they're ensuring that these schools that are coming in and opening up in those communities are actually serving students well and are actually demonstrating success, not just, you know, on par to what the traditional public school was offering. Are they doing anything better to enhance student outcomes? So I think these are the conversations we need to be having.
But for me, this all comes back down to the simple frame of poverty. And as I've said a million times on this program, I grew up a minority in a minority community. And for me, it wasn't about black and white. It was about green. We were poor. Mm-hmm. We grew up in a poor area. And all of the bad ideas, all of the gimmicks are what were tried on poor people. So it wasn't white people, black people, it was poor people. So for me, the key to all of this is poverty. So when we're talking about segregation, we've segregated ourselves based on poverty. Poor areas tend to be more minority driven because they're at a higher percentage of being in poverty. So shouldn't the argument be an economic one as well, saying, look, we need to be able to raise these communities up by getting jobs, by getting opportunities, maybe raising safety net, social safety net standards to give people better opportunities. That isn't that part of this?
Absolutely. Economic is a driving factor to school quality. So we need to be having, making sure that when we're talking about school quality and school outcomes and choice, that we're talking about the economics with that. Because to your point, you know, whether you are, you know, in a more affluent community, oftentimes that determines how your school is funded, right? So property values drive a lot of local funding that goes to school divisions. And there are many states that are still using staffing-based formulas to fund school. They're looking at, you know, staffing levels and salaries and benefits, and not looking at a student-based model, thinking about student needs, to your point about poverty, making sure that we're looking at the number of low-income students, the number of ELL students in those schools, the needs of those students, poverty level, and then determine a formula to fund schools based on that, based on those student needs, as opposed to looking at, you know, teacher staffing models and things like that. So I think we need to think about this more holistically, like the economic part, looking at the needs of students, low poverty, mental health needs, et cetera, and funding schools based on that, and not just letting property values and other models sort of drive the way that we fund and support our schools.
You know, just the other day we were talking about a new program for over the summer for kids just getting out of school. It was like an EBT card for summer that they were giving families like an extra $40 a month to feed kids who are coming out of school. And it got me to thinking about just how bad poverty is in a lot of school districts, and including the one I grew up in as a kid. The fact that, you know, we have destroyed so many of the social safety net programs. And I think back, and I've talked about this numerous times, when I was a kid, we went to Peerless Elementary School and lined up in the summertime to get a hot lunch at lunchtime. And for most of those kids, it was the only hot meal that they would get all day. And, you know, Reagan comes in, destroys all that, and with it, that public school. And we ended up losing that part of the community. This division of the private versus the charters versus all of these different schemes and gimmicks seems to me is really just tearing at the fabric of community and designed to tear us apart. So in light of, you know, 70 years of Brown versus Board of Education, you know, are we close to fulfilling that original thought, that original intent, or are we as bad as we were back then?
Yeah, I would say we have made gains in terms of getting over the hump of the legal barriers, right? In terms of breaking down, you know, separate but equal, that doctrine, but we're not where we should be as a nation. And this is not just about black and white. This is not just about rich and poor, right? I think there's so many, it's multi-layered as we think about all of the students that are in our schools, and even, you know, not a lot of conversations being had about students in rural communities. In a lot of rural communities right now, you know, those poverty-stricken communities, those students, to your point about vouchers, don't have the means to utilize those vouchers because a lot of those private schools are not in those rural communities, right? So if you're in a state where there's a voucher program, if you live in a rural town, you don't have access to that. Because how could you possibly get to a private school if your family does want you to attend that school? So I think we need to really, again, examine where we are, knowing that the public school demographics has changed significantly since Brown versus Board of Education. When Brown versus Board of Education occurred, we were talking about a majority you know, in terms of minority population, Black population. But now we have our Latinx students who actually far exceed the enrollment of Black students in K-12 schools now. So when you're talking about meeting the needs of students with limited English proficiency, and what are the equity challenges there that we're not addressing, right? And knowing that in some places, in some areas of New York City, those Latinx students are, again, in segregated environments because of, you know, charter schools and other models that have planted itself in the communities in which they live, right? So there, it's very complex, and we need to really examine where we are as a nation, the students that we serve, their diverse needs, and how do we truly achieve equitable learning environments, inclusive learning environments for students. And I think that really starts with what you raised before, the economic factor, making sure that we are funding schools, particularly schools that are low poverty, that we're funding them equitably. Research shows that in order to, you know, raise academic outcomes and address some of those poverty disadvantages that those students experience, you do need to fund those schools at 2 to 3 times the level as you're funding traditional schools. So we need to take heed to that and make sure that those schools are getting more investments because they need them. They don't need more schools in their communities. They need more investments in the existing schools that they're in. They don't need more charter schools.
So last line of questioning I want to get to you in looking at Brown, because I've heard people make arguments that maybe Brown wasn't the right decision, maybe enforcing the equal part, because as you've said, there's one side of the equation that is much better resourced than the other, because it seems to me, and you know, correct me if you think I'm wrong, that we've voluntarily separated ourselves and we've segregated ourselves, some by choice and some by poverty, that maybe the equal part we should be arguing as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that should be part of the discourse as we're thinking about how to dismantle the segregation that we're seeing. I do think that we have separated ourselves, to your point, based on local policies, local practices that are still in place till this day, right? Because again, if we're not addressing things like transportation, like just public transportation impacts where people live, right? Where you live determines on, school.
I grew up in a place that wasn't on the bus line. So I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, looking at all of those infrastructure, looking at housing, availability of affordable housing, that impacts, again, you know, where you go to school, where you're zoned for. So I think we need to look at all of these issues across different sectors and not just education. I don't believe that education alone can fix the problems in education. I think we need to be thinking about housing. We need to be thinking about transportation. We also need to be thinking about just the economic, just employment of different localities and how to address some of the challenges around that.
No, I mean, at the end of the day, it comes down to opportunities for everyone, mm-hmm. up and down the board. And sadly, I don't think we talk about that enough in the big picture. So when we talk about education, it's only education. I remember the Clinton years. We're going to get everyone education. Yeah, I grew up in the education's going to get everyone that corner office job. Well, there's only 4 corners in a building. What about everybody else? To me, there should be a lot of things we're doing that we're not. So any faith that we're going to move in this direction, given how dysfunctional our politics seem to be and how much the moneyed interests are all in on destroying our public schools?
I do believe that we are going to continue to make gains. And I do believe that we can reverse the state that we're in now if we ensure that we are deploying, again, funding to those underserved, under-resourced schools and communities in a way that truly allows those students to excel, right? It comes down to resources. That's right. What it comes down to. So we need to champion public education. We need to champion funding for public education and not funding for private education or disinvestment in public education to put towards private education. So I do feel like we can make that change as a nation, but it's going to take a collective effort across different sectors, and it's going to take a really strong commitment to invest in public education.
Ultimately, if we fail at this, we're going to fail the country in the future, because we're going to have a whole bunch of people who are going to be left behind, and that is not good for society as a whole. But Wia Day, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Good piece. I'd love to talk to you again at some point. Always good. Thanks so much. Wia Day James, Senior Director of K-12 Education Policy there at the Center for American Progress. Want to hear your thoughts. How are things in your local school? I hear all the time, you know, my school is good, but all those other ones out there, those are the ones we need to fix. Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Right back. Stick around.
Eagle 1490 AM.
Enjoying this local program?
Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Isolated evening storms, otherwise mostly clear and breezy for tonight with lows in the upper 50s. For tomorrow, a mixture of sunshine and clouds, still breezy, high lower 70s. Mostly sunny and warmer on Friday, high to 75. Currently at 64 degrees.
Do you know or work with kids who have special healthcare needs? Help them live their best lives. Contact Wisconsin Wayfinder Children's Resource Network. Our specialists will connect you with services in your area. Wisconsin Wayfinder is free and confidential. Call 877-947-2929 or visit dhs.wi.gov/wiscway. Connect today. Sponsored by the Wisconsin Department of Health Services.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, Michael Whatley, RNC co-chair, was on Newsmax, and he said that, look, the Republican Party, the RNC there, they are actually in preparation for the possibility that Donald Trump could be in prison, and they might have to have his acceptance speech given to the Republican National Convention from prison. He said that they're working on it. He's actually going to Milwaukee this week to going to have conversations on how they're going to get through there. Now, he says, we expect Donald to be in Milwaukee. He's going to be able to accept the nomination. But if not, we're going to make whatever contingency planning we need for it to happen. Now, the weird thing is this is president. This is a big deal. The fact that this is something that you have to worry about, is your presidential nominee going to be a guest of the state at the Gray Bar Hotel? I don't know. It's a good place for the country to be, which is why I've asked my next guest to come share some thoughts. The first person that I saw who said that Trump should drop out, he wrote a piece over at the Washington Monthly. Bill Scheer is the politics editor there at the Washington Monthly, washingtonmonthly.com, the website. Bill, thanks for taking time for us.
Always a pleasure to talk to you.
So you were the first guy who said, you know, it's time for him to go. You should step down for the good of the country, for decency. You know, Donald Trump has the opportunity to commit what you said was an uncharacteristically decent act and spare America from having a felon on the ballot. That's never going to happen. But I love it.
I do not expect it to happen. I don't expect Trump to bow out. I don't expect the Republican Party to force him off the ballot at the convention. But it should be said, I mean, any other politician for any level of office, when they get convicted of a felony, they drop out, they resign. That's pretty much a straightforward do not pass go situation. Any party, any time, that's what happens. Even if it's technically allowable, we have a basic sense of decency in the country that you don't want to have your office holders have violated the basic trust of adherence to the law. Look, there are people who break the law and they do their time and they repent and they've shown that they have reformed. And so then we allow them back into society. And perhaps maybe someone of that nature should give it a chance to run for office. Trump is not that person. Trump has not repented for his crimes by the remotest of long shots. And so a decent, rational party would say, thanks, but no thanks. We can find someone who agrees with you on all of your positions, who happens to not be a felon, and have the same debate that the country can choose which path they want to take. We don't need to have the felon to exist as a party, but that's not where Trump is, and it doesn't appear to be where the Republican Party is. But people should point out the obvious. Felons should stand down.
No, I'm with you. But you said there a second ago that we have a basic sense of decency in this country. My mind goes, do we? I mean, seriously, because I just saw this most recent YouGov poll. And I don't put an awful lot of stock in these polls, and I know that's manipulative and there's a whole bunch of stuff. But in April, just 17% of Republicans said that a convicted felon should be allowed to run for president or be president. There is now a 58% of the group saying that he should be able, a 41% increase over 2 months. So we're now normalizing. Yeah, what the heck? We could have a convicted felon.
Well, I think this Republican Party, the current state of the Republican Party, is doing that. They are, I mean, look, let's be a little fair here, okay? Bill Clinton, you certainly could argue, perjured himself when he was deposed by Ken Starr's special prosecution team. You could argue that he didn't technically perjure himself because he was being very careful with his word parsing. But if you want to say, look, we all know he was trying to mislead the prosecutors, that it was effectively perjury. I get the argument, but he wasn't tried by a jury of his peers. He was a sitting president, and so they couldn't do that. They had an impeachment, and he wasn't convicted in the impeachment. If that's something that happened before he was president, he was a candidate, it's not just, I mean, the argument from the Clinton people at the time was, well, this was a witch hunt. This is a Republican special prosecutor. They're trying to force this guy out. I'm not going to treat this as legitimate. I get all of that. This is what Republicans are saying right now about this trial. The difference is Trump was tried by a jury of his peers. If you want to argue that the prosecution was politicized, again, I'm not agreeing with it. It was not ordered by Biden, of course. He was a locally elected DA, but he was elected. It's a political position. I get that. Nevertheless, there is a basic check in the system. Jury of your peers. When I saw that jury picked and I saw that one of them was a Truth Social news consumer, I was like, oh, this is going to be a hung jury. There's no way they're going to get too unanimous on this jury. But here we are, because the case was made. Now look, and he can appeal. He can appeal. Maybe he wins on appeal. The system allows for that. But as of today, he is a felon, and he is not obligated to subject the country to having to ask themselves, should we allow a felon to be president of the United States? You could stand down and let someone else, again, shares your views. Your views aren't being shunted aside. It's just the felon should be shunted aside so we can have a debate about the issues. Yep. And not put someone there who is inherently suspect as far as the ability to be trustworthy.
Yeah, your bad ideas, those are still out there. But here's the most interesting response that I've heard. I had someone tell me that you do know that Jesus was convicted in a sham trial. So now we're taking a guy, and as you pointed out in your piece, a guy who cheated on his pregnant wife, a guy who's, you know, lied and cheated people out of all kinds of things. Basically, in my words, saw the Ten Commandments as a checklist rather than a list of things not to do. That he's now being compared to Jesus himself.
Well, yeah, look, you want to argue, look, I think this was a ticky-tack crime. This isn't like a serious felony. This should have been a misdemeanor at best. They had to really stretch to make it a felony. I understand the argument. I'm not saying I agree with them. I understand the argument. Let's just, for the sake of argument, say, you know what? This is barely a crime. Okay. What do we know as fact, regardless of whether it's a crime or not? He cheated on his wife while she was pregnant. He then tried to cover it up, and before the cover-up of the affair, mind you, he'd already enlisted a sleazy tabloid newspaper to smear his political rivals. And by skirting campaign finance laws to do that, because they weren't reported as in-kind contributions to the campaign, that money was all under the table. And then as part of that operation, they added on, oh, by the way, National Enquirer, can you also cover up the fact that I cheated on my wife while she was pregnant with the porn star? If you want to say, well, I don't consider that a felony. Okay. Is it a sign of good character? Is it a sign of trustworthiness? Is it a sign that this guy can be straight with you with information while he's president of the United States? And look, it's not even like this is some sort of exceptional situation. He's normally a good guy, but he got caught up in this affair. You know, even Alexander Hamilton had an affair. You know, Bill Clinton had an affair. We're not all perfect. I mean, I'm sorry to go on for ranting here, but this is something I wrote about today for the Washington Monthly. I mean, let's look back at the last 35 years of Trump, okay? When he published that ad in four New York newspapers after the Central Park jogger brutal rape, where six teenagers were wrongly accused and served time because of that, later exonerated. Trump published an ad a couple weeks later saying, bring back the death penalty. These were people who were charged. They weren't found guilty. Yeah, they were charged ages 14 to 16. I mean, obviously a horrible crime, but we don't normally execute teenagers. But that's what was going on here. That's what he was essentially implying. So he wanted to bring back the death penalty for that case. And he said we had to let police, you know, do whatever they want without worrying about quote unquote police brutality. Again, I'm not an anti-police person, I'm not a defund the police person, but there are rules everybody should follow.
Yeah.
We would normally say that's not just like run wild with have police, you know, beat the hell out whoever they want to beat the hell out of.
Yeah, I'm a support the police guy as long as they're not wrong.
Yeah. Now in that op-ed, he said specifically talking about the fact that people are allowed to rape helpless women. What does Trump do 6 years later? He raped somebody. I mean, I'm not just speculating that. He was found liable of, technically speaking, sexual assault of E. Jean Carroll. Again, another jury of his peers. And the judge said, technically under New York law, this is classified as sexual assault, but by anyone's common understanding of what the word means, this was rape. The judge said that after the verdict was found. I mean, to be blunt with you, the difference is whether he's using his penis or his finger.
Right. But this is also a civil trial as opposed to a criminal trial.
It was a civil trial, correct. But nevertheless, jury of his peers found liable. Okay. So again, claims to hate rape, then committed it. Now,
don't forget the Billy Bush, the tape of I just grab him by the you know what.
Well, that's right. Again, clearly, this is not something you might look, well, that was just locker room talk. No, he did it. We know he wasn't just talking about it. We know he did it. Jury of his peers, he did it. 2018, while he was president, said we should execute drug dealers. We should execute them. They should get the death penalty. 3 months later, he pardoned a drug dealer. And you could say, well, that was a sympathetic case. It was an African-American grandmother. And maybe she served 21 years. Okay, we know why he did it, not because he has compassion for African-American grandma drug dealers. He did it because he wanted to win votes from the Black community. He didn't pardon almost anybody else for those crimes. He first commuted, then pardoned, and then held her up at the convention, got her endorsement, then pardoned her. And more recently, just 2 weeks ago, Libertarian Convention, he said, I pledge to pardon Ross Ulbricht, who ran the Silk Road website, which managed a million drug deals, a handful of which led to deaths, and is now serving a life sentence. And you could say, well, I don't think you should serve a life sentence. I agree with the libertarians on that. Okay, Trump said we should execute drug dealers. But when it comes to trying to win votes, he says, forget what I said about that. I'll pardon this one. He does not care about the law.
Of course not.
It's not just about this one hush money case. He has a pattern of talking about law and order, and when it comes to himself and the pursuit of money and the pursuit of political power, he believes the law does not apply to him. There's no way you can put this person up as your nominee and say you're a law and order party, that you're a party of decency, that you're a party of family values. None of that holds if you cling to this guy.
But how is that any different than the arguments that I was making in 2015, knowing all of the things you had laid out, some of them, but knowing all the people that he had cheated out of business deals, all the workers he screwed out of wages, all the contractors who got screwed, all of the shady dealings and all this stuff, and the American people, or a good percentage of them, went to the polls and said, yeah, he's our guy.
Not most. He's never won the majority of the popular vote. But back in 2015, it was plenty of smoke, of course. We had lots of smoke that the guy was bad news, but we didn't have verdicts.
Nah,
we did not have a jury of his peers. And now we have that. And oddly, because it was a civil, not a criminal, the E. Jean Carroll verdict kind of came and went, but it's still a jury trial. And now we have another jury trial. And we have a third jury trial, the Trump Organization found of criminal tax fraud. I mean, these are not isolated examples. This is not just one case last week of a politicized prosecution. This is decades of behavior that is just now coming to roost. And there's even more to discuss. I mean, I haven't given you an exhausted list of all his hypocrisies when it comes to crime. Yeah. I'm just giving you some of the highlights.
No. But here's the thing. I go back to 2015. When he announced, this is one of the things that I was talking about back then, saying, look, I don't know why this guy wants to put himself under the magnifying glass. I don't know why he wants to get under the microscope and have all of his decades of Roy Cohn type dealing being examined by investigative reporters trying to make their bones, because I'm sure there are bodies buried all over the place and tons of crimes. So for me, the shock, and I got to tell you this, the shock is that this is it, that these few simple things, that's it. It seems to me that the pile of felonies and crimes should be much higher.
Okay, look, as Trump himself will point out, they only get Al Capone on tax evasion. He says this as if it's somehow an argument in his favor. But look. When was the first time Trump ran afoul of the law? I mean, as far as I know, it was over 50 years ago, 1973, when the Federal Justice Department sued Trump and his father and their company, Trump Management, of racial discrimination under the Fair Housing Act.
Right,
and Trump fought it. He didn't admit to anything. He fought it for 2 years. They eventually settled without a technical admission of wrongdoing, but with a so-called consent agreement that they would do things differently to ensure future discrimination didn't occur. And then 3 years later, the Justice Department said, you're violating the consent agreement. And they fought that. And then the agreement expired. It was 1982. It was the Reagan Justice Department. Those guys were not really, aggressive on enforcing the Fair Housing Act. But Trump got away with it. He got away with it.
Yeah.
And Trump has always been able, from a legal standpoint, to get away with it. That has been the lesson. I mean, it's like, what do you do when you got kids and you never follow through on your punishments? They say, well, I can get away with that. I'm going to keep doing it. My parents are soft. They're not cracking down on me. Trump has lived his life that he could always push off, always delay, always skirt, maybe settle sometimes, but they'll never actually get him guilty, never actually take his money, never actually serve any jail time. And he's almost 80 years old, and that's the case. So why start now? Why start being decent now is clearly how he's going about this. But to people who say he always gets away with it, he did lose. He did lose in 2020, and he could lose again.
I sure hope so. Look, I sure hope people find at least some of the decency that you've talked about and say, you know, we should be a little bit better than this. And as you've pointed out, Trump should drop out, not because it would be good for Republicans or good for Democrats, but because it would be good for America. And I agree with that.
It might be good for Republicans. It might be a lot better off.
It might actually be.
Getting a non-felon to lead their party. And just putting it out there. It's possible.
That could be their campaign shirt. Not a felon. Vote for me. Not a criminal. But Bill, I got to tell you, great piece. I hope folks will check it out over at the Washington Monthly. We'll get links out on social media. But the first guy who said, hey, you got to go. And I'm with you. Bill Scheer, thanks so much.
Take care.
Want to hear your thoughts. Is it time for Donald to step aside? What would that mean for the election? I have some friends who think that that's the only way Biden loses if Trump steps aside. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back to wrap things up. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1947. That was the day that Secretary of State George Marshall delivered a speech at Harvard University. In his speech, Marshall made a call for the United States to send assistance to European countries devastated by World War II. He declared, quote, "The truth of the matter is that Europe's requirements for the next 3 or 4 years of foreign food and other essential products, principally from America, are so much greater than her present ability to pay that she must have substantial additional help or face economic, social, and political deterioration of a very grave character." His speech became the basis for the European Recovery Program, or what became known as the Marshall Plan. The goal of the plan was to boost the morale of the Europeans while strengthening trade ties between the U.S. and Europe. There was great fear among leaders in the United States that economic instability would cause European countries to turn towards communism. Through the Marshall Plan, the United States sent aid in the form of grants, loans, and technical assistance. Much of the money went to purchase food and manufactured goods produced in the United States and sent to Europe. This demand helped to keep the American economy booming. In all, more than $13 billion in aid was sent to 16 European countries. Some European labor unions objected to American intervention in Europe as part of the plan. This caused contention between different European labor organizations. As some unions affiliated more closely with the communists, others aligned themselves with the West. The Cold War had taken its toll on labor solidarity. Labor History in Two brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Gotta tell you, I love Bill Scheer. I love the work that he does over there at the Washington Monthly. Hope you'll take a look at it, WashingtonMonthly.com. But the part in his piece that I found just almost laughable. And again, love Bill, and I'm not mocking the piece. The piece is great. But that Trump should drop out, not because it would be good for Republicans or good for Democrats, but because it would be good for America, like Donald Trump gives a rat's behind about America. And then to me, that's always been the central theme of why I don't want Donald Trump in the White House. Trump has always shown us he's been about Donald Trump, not about anyone else. And this idea that he's man of the people, he's the face of the working class. It's a guy who's never done an honest day's labor in his life. And yet working people are looking to him as the savior, which is really just bizarre. Our quote of the day from Stuart Stevens, a guy who has been a Republican operative for years. He tweeted out, "I worked on 5 presidential races and helped elect Republican governors or senators in over a half century. I have never heard anything more transparently desperate than a party trying to spin that there is some non-MAGA pool of voters who can't wait to vote for a convicted felon." And I agree with him. You're not going to grow new voters. Trump isn't going to attract new people who are going to go, "Oh boy, I can't wait. We're going to vote for the first felon." I don't know that group is out there. I don't. it's going to be about turnout. It's going to be about Democrats getting their heads out of their tuchuses and talking about the accomplishments of Joe Biden, and that Joe Biden is the guy who's going to lead us forward, going to move this country in a very good direction, as we've been doing. Lay out his agenda, what he's done, and there's a lot to talk about and move forward on this. And look, you know, my problem with our mainstream corporate-controlled media is they're still trying to make this a horse race. Yeah, you got a guy who's showing up, getting the Jelly Bucket Joe showing up, doing the job, running against a convicted felon. This, not normal. And as much as you try and normalize insanity, it's not normal. Also not normal, you've got the Republicans who are just itching, praying that they're going to be able to impeach Joe Biden for anything. And they've been trying. They've been trying their foolhardy best, but not enough for Marjorie Trainwreck Greene, who evidently tore into her Republican colleagues for their unwillingness to go after Joe Biden. In fact, you know, claimed that they had their heads up their you-know-whats. And she can't figure out, you know, why they haven't figured out how to use power, or I would argue, abuse their power. She said we should be voting to impeach Joe Biden because of the invasion of the United States. Oh, but no, none of that is happening up here in Washington because Republicans continually have their heads, you know, and can't figure out how to abuse the power the people gave us. Could it be he's not guilty of anything? Just kind of a thought, just throwing that out there. As the guy that you're lining up behind and all of the people who made the pilgrimage to the trial and wore the Trump costume with the red tie, you're following a convicted felon. And it's weird for me, but I guess this is the natural progression of where the Republican Party has been going for decades. This is now who they are. For instance, Republicans used to be against flag burning. Now the Colorado Republican Party, they have marked the beginning of Pride Month by, you know, calling, you know, people godless groomers and, you know, all kinds of stuff. And they're calling for the burning of all Pride flags. And here's the thing. I'm okay with it. Go ahead, burn it. You know, and then buy a couple more. And burn those too. And then go buy some more. And burn those. Do what you got to do. Do what makes you feel well. I believe in life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. As long as it doesn't hurt your neighbor, as long as the smoke isn't billowing through their windows, choking their children, burn it all you want. It's America. It's a free country. Or for now. And what's interesting to me is I hear my Republican friends talk about how the Democrats are trying to take their freedoms, trying to make them subservient to some who knows what the conspiracy du jour is, while simultaneously supporting people who are actively telling us what they plan to do. They plan on weaponizing our government. I said at the top of the show, got a guy running for Congress in Florida. Said, I'm going to lock up all those Democrats. They're the enemy. Remember, these are the people who were concerned and had multiple hearings on weaponizing government in the process of saying we're going to weaponize government. Kind of frightening, the world we're heading towards, which is why November is so, so vitally important, which is why getting out and voting, Democrats, is so vitally important. This is going to be a turnout election. There are no new unknown voters for Donald Trump. There's no pocket of undecideds out there. There are no basket of deplorables like my family members who had never voted, who actively went out and voted for Donald Trump. That doesn't exist this time around. So if Democrats stay home, we could wake up on that day after Election Day going, what? President who? Not a good place. I understand, you know, they're going to claim that everyone cheated and everyone, like, it was rigged. Joe Biden rigged the election. They're going to claim all that again, much like they did in 2020. And much like in 2020, they're never going to march it into a courtroom. Show up, vote. Show up, plan to vote, cast your ballot, make sure you're registered, all that. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at the ricksmithshow.com. Something I said got on your nerves, under your skin. Rick at the ricksmithshow.com. As always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Soaring high above La Crosse, this is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.